Hello, everybody. Welcome to EPA's Biodiesel Done Right Strategies for Municipal Fleets webinar. This is a fourth in a series of clean diesel webinars hosted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Region 2 office. These clean diesel webinars are intended to share information with local governments, municipalities, counties, etc., planning organizations, and other interested parties on several clean diesel topics such as air quality and climate change impacts, green construction, biofuels, and funding opportunities. Ultimately, these sessions will help communities integrate clean diesel practices into their environmental plans. Before we get into the main content of this webinar, let's go over some of the call logistics. This is a recorded session. In the next few days, the presentation and audio components of today's webinar will be available on EPA Region 2's website. And I'll go into more information on this at the end of the webinar, including a link where you can find the presentation materials. The panelists will be controlling the movement of the slides during the webinar, so you won't be able to advance the slides on your own, and it'll just happen automatically. There's a questions tab in the blue menu bar on the right of your webinar screen. We encourage you to ask any questions during the presentation. Please do not wait until the end of the presentation to submit your questions. If you have questions, just enter the question in the question box and click send. There will be breaks after each presentation, and the questions will be answered in the order they're received. Some of them will be answered by the presenter verbally, and some will be answered over the chat function. Attendees who are using the VoiceOver IP may have a slight delay in the audio. This is normal. And the attendees who are using the telephone for the audio, please enter your audio PIN if you haven't done so already. And if you're having any trouble with the audio, just send a question in the question box, and we'll do our best to take care of it. All right, now that that's all out of the way, let me go over the purpose of this webinar. We've seen really skyrocketing interest in green initiatives recently. Local governments, municipalities, they're all interested as much as any other group in experimenting with a lot of these different strategies. Biodiesel in particular, from recycled fats, oils, and greases, it's emerged as a very promising strategy, and it's one that's being adopted at the local level in a variety of forms. However, not all these programs are equal. And, you know, in fact, a lot of stakeholders have to be careful to avoid any unintentional negative impacts associated. But still, biodiesel, if done right, it can achieve really outstanding results for the environment, for human health, and even for the budgets. With this webinar, we really hope to educate local governments and others about some of the best practices and environmental rules regarding biodiesel. So in order to accomplish this, we're going to have a great lineup of panelists here. First, we have Jim Caldwell, who's our fuels expert at EPA's Office of Transportation and Air Quality. Jim's going to go over some of the rules that are there for producers of biodiesel, and this is to ensure good environmental results. We also have Carrie Ving, who is the biodiesel coordinator for San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Carrie's going to give some insight into her biodiesel program, which is it's really one of the most outstanding ones in the country. And finally, we have Brent Baker, who is the founder and CEO of Tri-State Biodiesel here in New York City. Brent's going to give his perspective from a company that has really led the way. You know, they're on the ground working with the community to collect the waste oil and convert it to biodiesel. But before we get to these panelists, I'm going to kick things off by just laying some of the groundwork and going through some of the background. My name is Dan Burkett. I'm an environmental scientist for EPA Region 2 in the air programs. For the past 3 years, I've focused specifically on reducing diesel emissions from motor vehicles all across the region here, and that's New York, New Jersey, and in the Caribbean. My work here on air pollution really touches some of the key environmental benefits of biodiesel. So I just want to go through a few of these. We've known for years that biodiesel has the potential to reduce harmful pollutants from diesel exhaust. In particular, biodiesel can reduce soot, which is also known as particulate matter, by up to 50% compared to biodiesel. Biodiesel is EPA-verified technology to reduce emissions. And this is very important because particle pollution, particulate matter, this is linked to some very serious health impacts, including asthma, cancer, and ultimately premature mortality. One of the other potential great benefits is a reduction in life cycle greenhouse gas emissions. Biodiesel is made from a renewable feedstock, and so carbon dioxide is absorbed as the feedstock grows, and thereby offsets much of the carbon dioxide that's produced during combustion. And so biodiesel compares favorably to petroleum-based diesel, especially if the biodiesel feedstock is a waste product, and that's recycled vegetable oil. In this case, the greenhouse gas reductions can be over 80% compared to petroleum-based diesel. And if the biodiesel program does include a collection of waste vegetable oils, and the waste streams will be diverted from the landfill, and the sewers can be prevented from clogs and overflows. We'll touch on some of this later in the webinar with some of the other presenters. And in addition to these, there's also a variety of non-environmental reasons that are very strong for setting a biodiesel program, not least of which is to promote energy independence and security. So these are all very good reasons for biodiesel, but what exactly are we talking about with the biodiesel program? What are the options for municipalities, local governments, or other stakeholders? So I just want to mention a few of these very briefly, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. The first thing, and the simplest thing, is really just to purchase biodiesel from a commercial vendor. And this option may be suitable to a lot of municipalities, particularly because of its ease. However, some of the environmental benefits, for example, preventing sewer blockages, they're not really taken advantage of if there's no collection of the waste oil, which could then be converted to biodiesel. So in order to capitalize on all these benefits, another option for municipalities and local government is to run a collection program and process that into waste, or process that waste into biodiesel. While the conversion process is not terribly complex, in fact, there's even some high schools that produce biodiesel as part of their chemistry curriculum. Ensuring the proper fuel quality, it can be a little bit tricky. Plus, municipalities will need to dedicate some resources in terms of manpower and expenses for equipment and supply. In case a municipality or local government or any other stakeholders can't really supply the adequate resources, there are other options, and they should look to partner perhaps with the private sector entity in order to maintain the waste oil collection and to convert that waste oil into biodiesel. So regardless of the option, there's a lot of potentials to save money relative to purchasing conventional diesel. But I do want to stress that the savings should not come at the expense of poor fuel quality, because that could end up costing a lot more in the long run, not to mention it might fail to meet the environmental goals. And before we go any further, I just want to clarify exactly what we're talking about with biodiesel. Biodiesel, it can displace petroleum-based diesel to fuel engines and boilers. It can be made from any number of renewable sources, like soy oil or cooking oil. These are the feedstocks, and in order for these feedstocks to be converted to biodiesel, this vegetable oil, it reacts with alcohol in the presence of a catalyst, and the products are glycerin and biodiesel. What biodiesel is, it's chemically composed of fatty acid methyl ester chains, and this should meet their ASTM standards to ensure the proper fuel quality. Biodiesel can be blended with petroleum-based diesel in any amount, but it's typically either 5% or 20%. That's denoted as B5 or B20. And please note here that straight vegetable oil, whether it's recycled or not, this is not biodiesel because it has not undergone the chemical conversion to fatty acid methyl esters. So, there's a lot of confusion out there, particularly in our region, so I just want to expand on vegetable oil briefly, as opposed to biodiesel being used as a fuel. Back when Rudolf Diesel designed his engine, he used peanut oil as a fuel, and that didn't last very long, and petroleum soon became dominant. And really over the past century, diesel engines have evolved and have been optimized for diesel fuel. As new alternative fuels come forth nowadays, you know, questions always arise as to how well they'll work with these existing engines, which are really designed for other products. This issue has been largely addressed for biodiesel, but vegetable oil is another matter. I have posted here on the slide, it's a statement from the Engine Manufacturers Association, which outlines some of the concerns associated with vegetable oil as a fuel without processing it into biodiesel. It all really boils down to, in the end, is that the higher viscosity and the chemical composition of the vegetable oil can lead to incomplete combustion, and that can ultimately damage the engine and result in higher emissions. And furthermore, if you use recycled vegetable oil, there's typically it's far from pure, and there can be contaminants within the oil that may result in some toxic air emissions. And you know, in order to ensure that this sort of increase in harmful emissions it doesn't occur from fuels, the Environmental Protection Agency has a set of rules that governs fuel use. So our next panelist, Jim Caldwell, will kind of explain these as they apply to biodiesel. But the main point that I want to make here is that vegetable oil, it's not recommended for use, and it may increase emissions. But biodiesel, on the other hand, that has been shown to reduce particulate matter and greenhouse gases and other pollutants. And furthermore, if it's coupled with a vegetable oil recycling program, then it can really be a great strategy for local governments. So with that, I'll pause and take any questions that we have before turning it over to our first panelist. Do we have any questions? Well, I'm not seeing any, so I will turn it over to Jim Caldwell. Jim's in our office of EPA's Office of Transportation and Air Quality. He has many years of experience in EPA's fuel and fuels registration program. He's been involved with biodiesel for the past decade or more. So Jim, thank you very much for joining us, and please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dan. At the Environmental Protection Agency, we have three registration programs that apply to biodiesel. The first one is what we call the Fuel and Fuel Additive Registration Program. And this is designed to give us information on the composition and the emissions from various fuels and fuel additives. Biodiesel, through its chemistry, falls into its own class or family. And the National Biodiesel Board did requisite testing on biodiesel to provide that information to us. They actually did what we call the Tier 1 testing and the Tier 2 testing. The Tier 1 testing is where you run an engine and look at all the compounds in the exhaust, and for any compounds that we don't find in the exhaust from a conventional diesel engine, they did a literature survey to look into the health effects of those compounds. The Tier 2 testing is animal exposure work to look at how animals respond to dilute emissions of biodiesel, and then we can compare that to what we know about the many years of tests that we have on diesel, regular diesel exhaust. So, and for biodiesel registration, we do have a specific form. It's EPA Form 3520-12. There's the web address for the form and its instructions. We ask also that with that you submit a description of the raw materials that you're going to use to produce your biodiesel and the process you're going to use, and then a lab report showing that you do meet the ASTM standard D6751. And here's a little more, a little summary on the health effects. Now, what the regulations state is that the health effects testing only needs to be done once, but then everyone should chip in to help defray the cost of that testing, and the regs give the original submitter 15 years to recoup its costs. The National Biodiesel Board did the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 testing, but if your business is under $10 million a year in annual revenue, and that's based on an average of your prior 3 years' revenue, you're only liable for the Tier 1. A second company called Next Fuels has also done the Tier 1, and my understanding is that they are not charging very much for access to that as opposed to what the National Biodiesel Board charges. So you can touch base with both of those folks and see which one works better for you. If you're over $10 million in annual revenue, you are required to also contribute to the cost of the Tier 2 testing, and that has only been done by the National Biodiesel Board. So the National Biodiesel Board's Tier 1 testing was submitted in 1998, so they've got a few more years to go for the Tier 1 and 5 more years for the Tier 2. After that, access is free and unrestricted. Okay, so that's basically it for the first registration program. There's now, we have two other programs. The ultra-low sulfur diesel program, which is designed to ensure that diesel fuel does not go over 15 parts per million, which is not much of an issue with biodiesel. And the second is the renewable fuel standard program. And I encourage you to go to our website. We just issued significant new regulations yesterday addressing that program. And both of those, registration is done electronically through our central data exchange system. That's also there on the slide. And that'll get you signed up for those two programs. And we have a lot of information on our website, too, on the background of those programs and the requirements. So if you have any questions, we're happy to answer them. You can also call me or send me an email. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for that information. You know, I think it's very important for everybody to understand that, you know, EPA's rules are in place to protect human health and the environment. And, you know, we've had a long struggle the last decade or more, actually, trying to improve emission standards and trying to bring down these harmful pollutants like particulate matter and others. And this fuel registrations program is a big part of that. You know, we need to know what's in the fuel. We need to make sure that it's good quality before people can start using it. I do have one question here, and it's about the registration program. Is that required regardless of the volume that's produced?
That's correct. There is no volume cutoff. You know, there are those small business provisions, but the regulations don't address volume. I mean, the one thing we have said is that if an individual is making it for solely for private use, in other words, not as a business, but if an individual is making it, we've ruled that individual does not need to be registered. But, you know, any sort of commercial activity would require registration.
Okay, thanks. Just going to see if we have any more questions. We're gonna pass the baton over to my colleague Bonnie Weinbach here, who's going to read some questions.
Hi, Jim. We have a few questions. Some of them are from about the new standard. The first one is, what is being done from the federal level to get all engine OEMs to allow B20? Many operators are reluctant to go to B20 because of warranty concerns.
Well, you know, I'd say here, we recognize that some engine manufacturers, you know, have concerns about B20, others don't. We've tried to, let the industry adapt to this. And, we feel that, certainly, we first registered biodiesel back in 1993. And, I think, The only real serious problems I've heard have been there was a Minnesota issue 1 year when they had a B2 mandate and folks weren't using enough pourpoint depressants or kerosene during a very cold time. I don't think there have been any real serious engine problems, but certainly, you know, we recognize that the engine manufacturers, particularly with the new emission standards and the new emission controls, are cautious. And so I think that what has been working for the past 15 years is working, is that we're gaining more experience with its use at B2 and B5 and now B20. And, I believe the engine manufacturers recognize that, renewable diesel and biodiesel are all going to become a much more important part of our overall strategy for fuels. And so I start to think, we're trying to work cooperatively and gain experience and, let the industry adapt and evolve.
Okay, thanks, Jim. We have a few more questions. The next one is, are there any similar requirements for biodiesel or waste vegetable oil burned as heating fuel?
I think this is a little tricky. I know that our stationary source people, a lot of it depends on the location. In certain states, stationary sources, depending on the location, have different requirements. And what I recommend is that you check with your local environmental office or your regional EPA office, because I think a lot of it depends on the size of the business and the location of the business as to whether, there are restrictions on the type of fuels that can be used in stationary source applications.
Okay, thanks, Jim. There's two questions about RFS2. One is, does EPA plan to hold any training seminars? And the other one is it true the recently published RFS2 rules puts all commonly produced B100 in the advanced fuel category, thereby making them more closely aligned with the greenhouse performance of waste vegetable oil?
I do believe we plan to have either some webinars or some public meetings that will, review the new requirements. I'm not an expert on a lot of the technical issues on RFS2, so I think I'm going to duck the second one. But if you want to submit it, give it to me in writing, I can get it to our experts.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I know.
Get back to you.
Yeah, great. Thanks. I know this is webinar, not focused on that, but the timing, I think, is such that people are curious. Okay, a couple more questions, and then we'll move to the next presenter. We have, do you approve fuels for particular purposes, example, on-road versus non-road? If so, what does EPA consider when approving for a particular use?
Well, the first program, Fuel and Fuel Lab Registration, only applies to on-road gasoline and on-road diesel. Now, most of the non-road biodiesel producers has also gotten registered because of the IRS requirement that you be registered if you want the dollar gallon tax credit. And, we do believe that we do require that the biodiesel meet the ASTM standard. So, but at this time, if someone wanted to produce a solely non-road diesel fuel, basically what the regulations require is that it be reasonably representative of a typical non-road diesel. And that's likely to become more stringent as more of the non-road diesel population is brought under emission standards. So, I wouldn't be surprised if we see the non-road diesel, in addition to the sulfur limitations that are taking effect, probably some additional requirements, probably in the next 3 or 4 years.
Okay, thanks, Jim. And one final question. Not sure if you'll know the answer to this, or maybe someone else, but do you know if there is any tie-in between a state SIP and the approval of a particular fuel?
The only one that I'm aware of is in Texas. Texas has what they call the TexLED program, which is Texas Low Emission Diesel. And there, as part of their state implementation plan, they are requiring a certain amount of NOx reduction from diesel, which is accomplished either by a specific diesel formulation or the use of additives that have demonstrated that they're able to provide the same NOx reduction as the specific diesel formulation. So I guess in that context, you know, it can be tied into a SIP. That's the only instance that I'm aware of.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Thanks for all that information, and please, if you have further questions, you can send them to us, and we'll do our best to answer them, even if they didn't get on the webinar today. We're going to switch gears a little bit and go to our second panelist, Carrie Ving. She's going to give us her experience running the biofuels program in San Francisco. As a biofuels coordinator for San Francisco's Public Utilities Commission, Carrie's responsibilities, they include citywide coordination of waste cooking oil collection from residents and food service establishments, developing a closed-loop city fleet fueling system from Friars to San Francisco fleets, while actively pursuing available funding and emerging technologies to convert brown grease and other lipid wastes into various biofuels. Carrie has experience in restaurant management, marine diesel mechanics, environmental campaigning, and she received her bachelor's degree in politics from Oberlin College. She sits on the San Francisco Biofuels Cooperative Board, the Mayor's San Francisco Biodiesel Excess Task Force, and its Marine Subcommittee. As I said before, you know, San Francisco's program is really the gold standard, really. So we're very honored to have you, Carrie, and please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thanks again to Bonnie Weinbach for allowing me to share our experiences. So SF Grease Cycle is, again, a program for the Public Utilities Commission Wastewater Division. We protect our sewers. Our main focus is with fat soils and grease, and I want to get started on that. What you see is a typical sewer lateral. This one is actually sewer main. You can see the fat soils and grease building up on the sides. We spend about 44% to 50% of our work orders that come through to dislodge our sewers and address sewer backups. They're grease related, and so what essentially happens is grease begins to take over large sewer laterals, sewer mains, cause a tremendous amount of backups. We spend about $3.5 million every year dislodging fat soils and grease from our sewers. In addition to that, we also are in charge of our entire sewer labyrinth. So we've got about 780 miles of sewers that we protect. Cost about $200 a linear foot to replace or repair the sewers. And when you start to look at this overall larger linear asset, you can recognize that even the smallest impact on the sewers results in millions of dollars in reduced assets. So that's one of the main drivers. What we set out to do is identify the problem with fat soils and grease in the sewers and figure out the role of government vis-a-vis the private industry in addressing these problems. Other variables that San Francisco has to address are regulatory. We've got the Clean Water Act, discharge issues. We also have what's called AB 32, you may have heard about that. It's our greenhouse gas emission reduction program in California. And essentially, we need to go back to 1990 greenhouse gas emissions. So all municipalities are scrambling to figure out how to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, particularly involving transportation. Unique to San Francisco, we have been running our 1,500 vehicle diesel fleet on 20% biodiesel since 2007. For the past couple of years, these are fire trucks, muni buses, street sweepers, and it's going very, very well. We do source our biofuel from the Midwest. It's soy virgin. And so that's definitely a step in the right direction. We feel we could take it further in harvesting local feedstocks to generate our own biodiesel right here in our backyard. So that has been the plan. I'm not going to go a lot into the details of this slide, but overall I just want to give you a sense of the fact that we initially went the typical regulatory route with the restaurants discharging grease into our sewers, requiring that they install grease removal devices and that they not pour cooking oil or other greases down the drain. What we found is that a lot of the mom-and-pop establishments in our prize restaurant industry really had a difficult time complying. They paid a lot of money to have their material, their grease, and their cooking oil taken off site. That's when we decided to begin an initial program to divert these fat, soils, and grease right at the source through a free cooking oil collection, knowing that we could turn the fat, soils, and grease into AST and biodiesel. So there's two components. There's a yellow grease component and then there's a brown grease component. I'm going to start with the cooking oil, also affectionately known as yellow grease. We essentially have, since 1997, about November of 2007, we started up a free collection service with about 30 restaurants, provide them with containers. And there is the smallest amount that we collect is about a couple gallons. So we're really reaching out to the mom and pops. We have about 800 restaurants that we now service out of 2,600 food service establishments. The majority of these are mom and pops. We typically collect cooking oil in 5-gallon totes. And have been working very closely with your non-traditional food service establishments, synagogues, churches, hospitals, caterers. And what we found is it actually has been a larger problem than we had even realized. When we started up this program, we had a number of these smaller restaurants stockpiling the cooking oil that they had used from their fryer in their basements. The typical progression went, they tried to pour it down the drain backed up, and they just began storing it in their basement. Our fire department was unaware of this, our health department was unaware of this, and we really, in some cases, really came to the rescue for a lot of these smaller establishments. Interesting story is this is just from one restaurant. We actually collected these totes and then went to the backyards of the cooking staff and picked up jugs and jugs from their backyard. This is again from one restaurant. And so we realized that it may not be practical for the private grease haulers to pick up some of the lesser amounts of cooking oil. We want to provide a safety net. Very few of our establishments that we service are the larger restaurants and hotels. Again, the majority of our focus is on these smaller establishments. What you see is a map of San Francisco. The red stars are food service establishments that have had grease backups to the point of notices of violation or interruption of service. The yellow drops are the restaurants that have signed up with SF Recycle that we service. And we compiled this map a year into our program to see if we were actually reaching out and responding to the restaurants that we had intended to reach out to. And surprisingly, we are. It's fantastic. We've pretty much covered just about every red star. We have a lot of word of mouth that has led us to not only work with restaurants and some of their neighbors on collecting their cooking oil, but also instilling best management practices to restaurant owners and staff, helping them with their grease removal device choices, and breaking down the natural adversarial relationship that you typically have with a regulatory agency and the industry that it regulates. Again, everyone who is involved in the biofuel industry knows that back in summer of 2008, when oil prices peaked, so did cooking oil prices. What we found is that a lot of restaurants went back to the private sector because the private sector was not charging them. Private grease haulers were actually offering money for cooking oil at the time. Once that price dropped to below 5 cents a pound, we saw a lot more restaurants having difficulty getting rid of their fat, soils, and grease again and their used cooking oil. So what we've realized is even if we only service a certain section of the industry, even if we're just hand collecting those 5 gallon jugs, we know that we're providing a safety net in keeping grease out of the trash and the drains. We'll always provide some sort of a role and leave the rest, the larger restaurants, the larger hotels, to the private sector that can back up to a loading dock and in 15 minutes take 300 gallons. But this private sector is not necessarily equipped to make money off of pulling into a restaurant, going down 2 floors, and just grabbing a few totes amounting to 20 or 25 gallons. If we didn't collect those 20 or 25 gallons, we're not exactly sure that that material would go into a proper place. A big component of the SF Recycle program has been education. Our main message is we want to make sure that restaurants understand it's not an option to pour grease down the drain. It's not an option to throw it in the trash. So in multiple languages, we explain this free service. We have useful information on how to store and handle used cooking oil. We have a robust website. And typically for the industry, we also have the containers that we hand over have instructions in multiple languages. We provide any type of service we can to make it easier for restaurants to be able to safely store and handle the cooking oil. Another component of SF Recycle is the residential sector. What we found, and I believe it is an EPA or NREL statistic, but approximately half of any urban fat, soils, and grease that's ending up in sewers is coming from the residential sector. That is considerable. Our message is every drop counts. Even a teaspoonful multiplied by 750,000 people has a very big impact on our sewer system. So we do post-holiday events after Chinese New Year, Christmas, turkey fryers during Thanksgiving, and we have residential drop-off sites across the city to encourage restaurants to drop off their cooking oil for biofuel. The main message is if it's not convenient to have it recycled into biofuel, we get it. Just make sure it doesn't go down the drain. As you can see, we also have our muni buses have instructions for residents on recycling cooking oil and where to properly place it. So the residential program has been a great success. We've been working with a lot of the local grocery stores, Whole Foods, Costco, a lot of the community centers across the city, and are reaching out to fire stations, churches, synagogues, and some of the larger residences, like multi-dwelling residences, to establish drop-off plans. The only thing that we ask of residents, as you can see, is plastic, non-breakable containers with tight-fitting lids. As far as the overall program, you know, again, we work for the, you know, we're a government agency. So a big focus has been on workforce development and green jobs, specifically targeting environmental literacy in the workplace. We have about 12 staff, all of which are in various stages of workforce development. We offer low and moderately skilled opportunities. Again, operating within the walls of a sewage treatment plant, about 45 to 50% of our wastewater workforce is eligible for retirement right now. So we're bringing in a new cross-section of people to learn what it's like to work in resource recovery on a wastewater treatment plant, that it doesn't just address what comes in through the headworks, but also equally addresses diverting materials that don't belong in their sewers at the source, starting with cooking oil, moving into restaurant trap grease, and eventually moving into harvesting our sewers of that lodged grease and turning that into some form of biofuel. At our Oceanside treatment plant, we have a brown grease to biodiesel demonstration. Just to explain where the cooking oil goes that we collect, the Public Utilities Commission in 2006 purposefully decided not to locate a small biodiesel processor for cooking oil back then, because we have four existing biodiesel manufacturers that are capable of converting this cooking oil. We had a strong feeling that if we did the conversion ourselves, we could potentially certainly disrupt or possibly put these smaller industries out of business. So instead, what we do with the cooking oil is, in rotation, we sell this cooking oil to the four biodiesel manufacturers in rotation at about half of the Jacobson Index. We're in the process of finalizing with our city attorney a tolling agreement, which is a service agreement to be able to purchase the biodiesel back into the city, so that the cooking oil to biodiesel and back forms a nice solid closed loop that really has less than a 10-mile radius. And that is actually something that we're really excited to post on our website for other municipalities to take a look at, because it's been 18 months in coming and we're surprised at how difficult it is to form that tight closed loop with all the regulatory requirements. But again, right now we have a brown grease to biodiesel demonstration. The role that we're playing is to bring some of the local, not quite commercial technologies to market. We have been working with the California Energy Commission, the EPA, and the Department of Energy have all given us grants to essentially take restaurant trap grease, about 10,000 gallons a day, and turn it and dewater it to turn it into brown grease, which is about 3% of the overall trap grease. The rest is water. So that leaves 9,700 gallons of wastewater, which typically would be a production cost for a traditional biodiesel manufacturer. In the case of co-locating our brown grease to biodiesel processor within the walls of our sewage treatment plant, what we can do is we love that 9,700 gallons. It's nutrient-rich fortified water for our digesters. Increases our methane production, which helps us pull our treatment plant off of the grid. The remaining 300 gallons that I mentioned is converted into ASTM biodiesel, also fuel extenders, fuel additives, what we're calling biobunker. And all of that material, if we so choose, can also be fed into our digester to increase methane production to, again, help our treatment plant pull itself off the grid. One interesting note is that treatment plants across the country use a tremendous amount of energy. It takes about 3% of America's available energy to process our sewage. And every single treatment plant with increased methane production could pull itself off of the electrical grid. So we're carrying through that type of analysis alongside with if we utilize the BTUs from this grease and made biodiesel, if we utilize the BTUs to make biobunker, and then to be able to offer to other municipalities a cost comparison so that they can make the decisions on, one, how to deal with their fat, soils, and grease, and two, what are the appropriate applications. This is a 12-month demonstration, and we're just about to kick off production on the first week of March. We definitely encourage any questions from other municipalities, and we'll be working with the EPA Region 9 to develop a, quote, toolbox that will be posted on our website for other municipalities to download the business case, our cost-benefit analysis, the choices that we've made to determine if it's appropriate for their municipality. If anyone does have any questions, I encourage inquiries. We're more than happy to give tours, and please feel free to contact me. That's our status as of now. And if there are any questions right now, I'd love to answer them.
Great. Thanks, Gary. Wow, that was excellent. I do have one question here. It is, do you have any recommendations for a smaller municipality starting a program? Any recommendations for starting with residents, restaurants, or bigger facilities?
Yeah, I do. I think that I really encourage regulatory agencies to better understand where the material is going. That means working with the restaurants. It means working with the private haulers and celebrating what they do every day, which is very, very hard work. The goal here is to make sure the material is not going in the sewer. If you are able to work with private industry and private haulers to ensure that, I think that's the best approach. As far as the residential sector, I did mention the outreach is our most critical component. If you can get the word out to residents that that pouring grease down the drain with a bunch of hot water does not solve anything, it creates many more problems, then you've really won your battle. Being able to collect that material and turn it into appropriate resources is really icing on the cake as far as the residential sector.
Okay, great. I got another question here. Do you find SF GreeCycle competing with residents that harness vegetable oil for their own diesel-powered vehicles?
That's a good question. We're first and foremost a regulatory agency to keep fats and grease out of our sewers. We do have to recognize that we're very concerned with private individuals making arrangements with restaurants without proper spill containment. And what we're finding is a cyclical nature, much like I'd shown in that one graph, where there are a lot of individuals that come out to collect the SV, the straight vegetable oil, from restaurants when diesel prices are high, and then they do tend to disappear when diesel prices are low, and then I guess biodiesel prices are low. I'm not exactly sure why it is. We've only gone through one cycle of seeing the up and down, but we found a considerable amount of restaurants that have called us saying, hey, I had a guy that used to come, and now we don't know where he is. We're in big trouble. We're overflowing with oil. So that's pretty much our stance. We're not really competing. I think the overall the California Food and Agricultural Division really regulates these individuals, and as long as the oil is not going down the drain, we haven't really pursued any action or taken a stance on individuals collecting their cooking oil from restaurants.
Okay, thanks. Another one for you. Is there a model for recovering waste grease from sewers?
Not yet. There are two types of waste grease that we're interested in. The waste grease from sewers is kind of in that second slide that I showed you. That's lodged. That is, with a high lipid value, high BTU, but again, it is what's called adulterated. It is has made contact with the sewers and is a bit more difficult to clean up. There's another material called scum. Scum actually does have a definition, and that's the grease that ends up in our sewage treatment works. Very similar. Both of these materials have a high lipid value, and I believe that once we really work with these private industries to understand and convert brown grease to biodiesel, what's called black grease is the next step.
Okay, excellent. We got another one here, follow-up. How do you fund pickups of oil from small restaurants?
Well, we fund it through cost savings. It's a comprehensive program. The oil collection is one component. Working with restaurants to install the proper grease removal devices is another component. The brown grease to biodiesel program is yet another component, and then we have our residential outreach. So we're funded by, it's a program that's funded by ratepayers that, pay for their sewer and water. But the real cost benefit is in net revenue savings. It's in the $3.5 million that we're spending each year to dislodge the fat, soils, and grease. As we continue this program over the next decade, probably similar or analogous to a 70-year-old person eating cheeseburgers every day, they go vegan. It's going to take a while to clear out those arteries, but common sense tell you if you're not putting bad things into the system, you'll eventually be able to have a clean working system. And again, we spend so much money protecting our sewer labyrinth that it makes sense to keep it clean.
Okay, great, thanks. And anybody else who has questions, please feel free to contact us or Carrie at the end. We'll be showing a link where all the presentations are made available, so you can check that for contact information as well.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. Now we're going to turn to our third panelist, Brent Baker of Tri-State Biodiesel here in New York City. Brent is really a pioneer of biodiesel. He's been an entrepreneur, an educator, a producer of biodiesel since it really emerged about 15 years ago. Brent founded Tri-State Biodiesel in 2004 after working for years as an executive director of biotour.org. Which is a nonprofit organization that specializes in global warming, sustainability, and biodiesel education. Under Brent's leadership, Tri-State Biodiesel has become the most well-known and biggest biodiesel company in the region and a national pioneer in urban sustainable biodiesel. Brent is a nationally known spokesman on biodiesel and related issues, and has educated hundreds of thousands of Americans about the dangers of global warming and the benefits of biodiesel fuel. So Brent, thank you so much for joining us. It is an honor, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and thanks also to Bonnie and all the leadership there at the EPA for inviting me to share our experience today. So I guess I'm just going to go over a little bit about our company and touch a little bit on some of the benefits of biodiesel, particularly from our perspective here in New York, and then talk a little bit about some recommendations that we see that might help the kind of thing that we're doing and that Kerry's doing in other areas. So Tri-State Biodiesel was founded in 2004. It was founded by myself and a group of environmental-minded investors, and I founded it after about 10 years of biodiesel education, and I was the executive director of a nonprofit organization where we spoke for many years about biodiesel. So I have the opportunity to see the biodiesel industry emerge and evolve over the last 15 years, and it's been a lot of fun and a very interesting time. We're headquartered in New York City. We're actually in Hunts Point, the Bronx, and we have operations throughout the five boroughs of New York, as well as operations in New Jersey and Connecticut. We're the leading biodiesel brand here in the city. We're the first to offer biodiesel fuel to private fleets here in the city, and to offer a closed-loop oil to biodiesel recycling service here in the city. Tri-State is a national pioneer in urban recycled oils. Our focus has always been on the recycled and waste cooking oils segment of the biodiesel industry. We do interact with the National Biodiesel Board and work with them on various initiatives. And as I said earlier, about 15 years of biodiesel experience, and we've really been lucky to be a part of the evolution of this industry. The services overview for Tri-State, we provide used cooking oil recycling service, and we sell retail biodiesel fuel and biodiesel heating oil to private consumers. And we also do a lot of education and promotion of the fuel, as well as outreach around legislative issues. Our waste collection service is currently servicing about 2,700 restaurants. These are all manner of food service establishments, everything from small mom-and-pop restaurants to large food service chains and also other food service providers. We service Yankee Stadium, for instance. We service Grand Central Terminal. So we really run the gambit from small to large and all the different kinds of establishments that need the service of recycling their fats, oils, and greases. We employ 26 workers, mainly from low-income communities. We actually work with the nonprofit community, nonprofit organizations here in New York to source our employees, and we're very proud of our track record of providing green jobs. Our service saves – oh, I'm sorry, I'm having a little problem here. There we go. Our service saves the city on enforcement and cleanup of fats, oils, greases, which we just heard all about. And we also have made our service very convenient for restaurant partners. I should mention it's a free service, and not unlike San Francisco Grease Cycle, we saw before we entered the market that most people were having to pay for the disposal of their fats, oil, and greases, and because of the fee, we found a really high incidence of illegal dumping of the material. We saw this as a business opportunity because being connected to the biodiesel industry, we understood that that material could be turned into a profitable material. So all our trucks, of course, run on biodiesel fuel and have been since the beginning of the company. We also provide a fleet fueling service. We do fleet fuel in for about 300 heavy-duty fleet trucks in the city right now, and that roster is ever growing. And we provide biodiesel fuel directly to the fleets, in some cases to tanks that they fill the fleets, in other cases directly to their fuel tanks. We provide various blends to different customers, ranging from B5 to B20, depending on a particular customer's preference what kind of vehicles they're using. Some of our fleets that we service can be seen here, Marjam, Green Depot, Fresh Direct, Whole Foods, and a lot of smaller local businesses. We also provide home heating oil here in the Northeast. About 50% of the residential buildings are heated by heating oil, and in that case, we can substitute a biodiesel blended heating oil for number two, and we do. And so we provide that as a 20% blend of biodiesel, and it can be used in any number two or number four heating boilers. The heating oil is supported by New York State, and they actually provide a 20-cent per gallon tax credit for a B20 fuel. That tax credit is lessened with the percentage of fuel. So, for instance, a B5 heating oil would be eligible for a 5-cent per gallon tax credit. Our fuel is generally priced at or below petroleum heating oil, particularly when the credit is added into the price. A little bit about biodiesel, most of you may know, but I do like to touch on this when I do presentations. Obviously, it's a clean-burning alternative diesel fuel produced from renewable resources. Biodiesel contains no petroleum but can be blended with petroleum diesel. As we know, it can be used in any diesel equipment with little or no modifications, particularly in a blend. And biodiesel, in its pure form, is readily biodegradable and drastically reduces emissions. Biodiesel is made through a chemical process called transesterification, whereby the glycerin is separated from the fat or from the vegetable oil. The process leaves behind two products, methyl esters and glycerin. Biodiesel can be made from virgin seed oils, waste cooking oils, animal fats. And in America, it's made from all three. A brief illustration of our system here. We provide barrels and storage containers directly to restaurants. We send out our fleet of trucks two shifts a day to those restaurants to pick up their cooking oil. We use vacuum pump equipment, or we hand take the 5-gallon totes, and we bring that back to our headquarters where we purify the oil. We put it through filtration and through a water removal process, and then it is converted to biodiesel at a biodiesel facility. We then, through tolling arrangements, bring the biodiesel back into our market and blend it with petroleum diesel, where it is then sold to the end-use consumers. So we have created a closed loop here for a lot of New Yorkers where there's, you know, literally buildings where there's a restaurant at the bottom of the building, we get their oil, and later our truck will come and fill up their boiler, and that restaurant is heated by the biodiesel that their oil went into making. So the next heater that warms you, the next car you drive, may be fueled by biodiesel from a local recycled vegetable oil. Some of the benefits of biodiesel are health, their greenhouse gas reductions, their local air quality, and also energy security, local economy, and sustainability. I'll just touch on some of those. Emissions reductions, biodiesel in its pure form has no sulfur, so the yellow bars here are the emissions reductions with 100% biodiesel, and the green bars here are emissions reductions of 20% blend of biodiesel. So you can see that those are all significant reductions, unburned hydrocarbons, particulate matter, things that cause health problems, and life cycle CO2 and carbon monoxide that cause global warming all reduced with biodiesel use. So carbon reduction, which has been a big topic for the EPA, obviously, in the last year, really trying to nail down the exact percentage of carbon reduction for biodiesel. The initial studies that have been used indicated somewhere around 70 to over 80% emissions reduction, so about 17.3 to 17.5 pounds per gallon of carbon reduction compared to diesel fuel. So this is very significant, and what we did here is just looked at how many gallons of biodiesel was produced in the U.S. in 2008, multiplied it by the 17.3 pounds, and realized that the U.S. biodiesel industry reduced carbon by about 12 billion pounds in 2008. If we look at the EPA data for the average car emissions, we realize that this is an industry that has removed about a million cars off the road for an entire year in the year 2008. So I think biodiesel, just in that alone, shows that it's a very effective way to reduce global warming emissions. The other thing that's very important to us here in New York is health benefits of biodiesel. We have some of the highest asthma rates in the United States in some of our communities here in New York. In fact, the community where our business is located has schools which report a 1 in 4 children with asthma and other lung diseases. So this is a major problem. And when you look at maps that show lung diseases in children, and then you overlay it with maps of diesel truck routes, you will find that these maps correlate. And we know that New York City actually has the highest incidence of lung disease and premature death nationwide as a result of petrodiesel exhaust. So it's a very serious problem, and it shouldn't be minimized. So the American Lung Association has been very supportive of biodiesel use. They have a flyer that says that biodiesel is 90% less toxic compared with petroleum diesel. We know the particulate matter is quite a bit reduced with biodiesel, so that's another great reason to use the fuel. Biodiesel, obviously, is a domestic fuel, particularly in the way that we're talking about, using waste cooking oil. So it does create safe and stable green jobs for American workers, and that's another thing that is so important to us right now. It also keeps our energy money here in our economy rather than sending that capital abroad. And, of course, there's no overextension of military resources needed to protect the supply of biodiesel until, at this point anyway, we haven't seen any fighting over soybean fields or waste cooking oil containers. Biodiesel made from UCO, which is used cooking oil, can also be called waste cooking oil or straight vegetable oil or yellow grease, although in the industry we tend to think of yellow grease as a refined oil, not a raw oil. But at any rate, there's some specific benefits that come from biodiesel made from used cooking oil. They do save taxpayer money because of all the reasons that we heard about with Kerry, removing it from the sewer system, eliminating sewer clogs, eliminating street closings. I know that I've been in meetings with our local municipality folks that take care of the sewers and the DEP, and they tell us that a lot of the expense in their budget, just as it is in San Francisco, is replacing sewers that were clogged related to fats, oils, and greases. So it is a nuisance product, and prior to our arrival on the market and creating a free service, it was often illegally dumped in fairly high quantities. Obviously, the fuel is made from a waste product. This is excellent from a sustainability standpoint, and of course, it does support more local jobs when you are collecting material rather than growing it. You're making actually a lot more jobs per gallon. And the energy balance story, which is so important. This chart here shows the life cycle energy analysis for various fuels. This comes from National Renewable Energy Laboratories. And you can see that petroleum diesel yields less than one unit of BTU energy for each unit of BTU energy that's put into harvesting and moving and refining the fuel. With soybean biodiesel, and actually this is old data, newer data even suggests that it's higher, but the soybean biodiesel is at least a 3.2 times energy positive. That means that 3.2 times the energy comes out of the process of making soy biodiesel as what goes into it. And with recycled vegetable oil, the study found that that number skyrocketed to a phenomenal 5.5 units of energy for every one unit used to make it because of the second use of the material. So it's a very good feedstock for biodiesel. My recommendations here, in our experience in working with the local officials, are four parts to it, really. Regulations, enforcement of the regulations, legislation in support of biodiesel, and private sector partnerships. So regulate in order to control illegal dumping. I think that's happening in a lot of the larger municipalities. I think that it might not be happening in some of the smaller ones. We do require that all cooking oil be properly disposed of here in New York and in San Francisco, and hopefully that will happen in all municipalities. Stringent regulations requiring the proper disposal and prohibiting, obviously, illegal dumping. Carters also should be required to report the destination of the product. Obviously, we're not doing any good if carters are charging for picking up the product and then dumping it illegally themselves. And thirdly, restaurants need to be required to recycle the oil with a compliant carter. Educate and enforce the rules. And this is something that, you know, in New York, with 20,000 plus food service establishments, has been, you know, sometimes a difficulty, and I suspect it's difficult in other places as well. There just aren't enough officers to go out and really enforce these rules. So I think that, you know, we've advised that the enforcement should be done by the health department agents that regularly visit the restaurants rather than the DEP, or in conjunction with the DEP, just because there are so many more of those officials and they're out in the restaurants. Secondarily, or really first off, should be educational campaigns so that when a food service establishment gets its license or renews its license, that the rules around keeping their oil and disposing of that oil are very, very clear to them, because it's not often clear to an entrepreneur starting a restaurant what they're really supposed to do with the oil. So that needs to be made clear. And also, the structure should be clear and consistent of the fines or the consequences of illegally dumping or of not having proper records and enforced consistently. Thirdly, legislate to promote biodiesel. That's been done a bit here in New York, and municipalities really around the country have done things to support the use of biodiesel, and we see this as a great step forward, and really want to encourage more of that kind of thing. For instance, a tax exemption for heating oil that has biodiesel in it here in New York is one example. And another example might be in Nevada, where they are mandating that biodiesel blends be used in school buses in Las Vegas. And that's another great example. And in fact, I cite the school buses because I feel that promoting the use of biodiesel to get the highest benefit out of it is another important thing. If we have a limited amount of biodiesel and we put it in a school bus, we can capitalize not only on the greenhouse gas emission reduction, but also on the health benefit for the kids that are in that school bus. So I think that's a real win-win-win to use it in that way. And also to encourage the feedstock use of used cooking oil as a feedstock by offering a premium in municipal contracts. And that's something that we've seen in New York and some of the other big cities where they'll offer a premium for the use of recycled materials, for instance, when they do procurement. This is something that can be done at very low cost to the municipality, but really encourage more local sustainability. So we really like that as well. And this is my last slide. We want to capture efficiency and innovation through private partnerships. I just want to recognize that the private sector is already doing a lot of this work around the country. There may be a little bit more education. There may be additional support they can gain to do this better, but they're certainly out there doing this work. And these partnerships will support green jobs and the most efficient use of our taxpayer money. And they also really create innovation, and the competition in the marketplace will continue to encourage those innovative breakthroughs in our industry. So I want to thank everybody for listening, and I certainly welcome questions and discussion both now and in the future, and my contact information is there on the slide for anyone that wants to get in touch with us.
Thanks for that great presentation, Brent. We do have some questions. First, what grades and quantities of the bioheating oils are available, and what's the average or maximum storage time, storage lifetime?
Any blend could be available at a customer's request. However, we generally just sell the B20 product. And we sell that to all of our bioheat customers. And the way our tax credit is set up, that there's a financial encouragement to do B20. So I think that we haven't had any problems with that blend level, so we're pretty happy with continuing that for the moment. In terms of, what was the other piece of the question?
The storage lifetime.
I think it's generally 6 months is a good rule of thumb.
And can you explain a little bit why that is?
That's based on testing done by the National Biodiesel Board and related companies, and that's just kind of the industry standard as far as I'm aware of.
Okay. All right, thanks. Another question. For those without on-site fueling options, how can you provide fueling options to fleets within the city, in New York City?
Well, if people have a trucking fleet, we can come and fill up their individual trucks at night when they're parked, and we do that. Or if they have a fuel pump of their own, we can certainly provide the fuel in that way. In the future, we hope to also sell the fuel through gas stations, and in fact, there is a proposal for an alternative fueling station here in the Bronx that will offer biodiesel blends as well as ethanol and compressed natural gas. So it's just a chicken and egg thing. As demand increases, it's easier to get the fuel into gas stations, and that's kind of where we're aiming for.
Okay. Another question about the price, actually. How does the biodiesel prices compare with the existing ultra-low sulfur diesel rack prices for a couple blends for B5 or B20?
Questions of price on the road fuel really have more to do with delivery location and quantity than they do type of fuel. That being said, our company has the ability to match the prices of ultra-low sulfur diesel for most customers, except for the very smallest customers. you know, and it really, again, it comes down to the cost of delivering the fuel. So larger quantities, we certainly can compete because we have a lower cost feedstock.
Okay. One question about the green jobs. I think you quoted a number earlier, and there's a question. What kind of numbers do you have for creating green jobs?
Yeah, I have it in the slides. We have about 26 employees, including management, here now, and we continue to grow. A lot of what we do is driving trucks and operating hoses in restaurants, and that tends to be a little more labor intensive, as opposed to buying large quantities of pre-made feedstock for biodiesel. So because of that, there's a higher job per gallon rate with these collection operations.
Okay, thanks. And there's another question about some of the cold weather properties. Is there a specific cold weather blend formula?
Yes, there are additives, and there's also a blend adjustment. We, in our own trucks, we tend to go up to about B50 in the summer, and we tend to go down to about B20 in the winter in the coldest months. And there's customers that do that as well. They'll go from sometimes B20 in the summer and then to B5 in the coldest months and back. And we do also additivize our fuel, and we also recommend certain feedstocks which actually perform better in the cold months. Some of the animal fat and heavier oil-based biodiesels, we would recommend those more for warmer months or warmer climates, and we would stick with the yellow grease, soy and canola type of blends for coldest climates.
Okay, great. I got one other question. About whether you can work with municipalities to sell biodiesel or discounted biodiesel from which they offer UCO or UCO.
Well, I certainly, municipalities, tend to be buyers of biodiesel, around the country, and hopefully will continue. Here in New York, it's done by bid. So you have to register as a vendor, and then you bid on the full quantity of the fuel. So I don't know if that quite answers the question.
I think so. Back to the green jobs question, somewhat rephrased. Has Tri-State Biodiesel trained or hired any green jobs within the local communities?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. As I said, we do our hiring through local nonprofits that specifically do placement for low-income persons or persons that have been out of work. And so that's our hiring pool. And when we bring them in, we have training support for them. We train our guys. And everyone is also, as part of that training, gets educated about biodiesel, and through getting educated about biodiesel, learn about global warming and learn about some of the other things that we deal with in the biodiesel industry, the environmental ideas. And so what happens through that process is that folks that often weren't extremely aware or maybe had the environmental issues on the front burner of their minds get a lot more educated around environmental issues as part of the job training here, and that will continue. We're very happy with that. In fact, we got a small grant recently to continue and enhance some of our job creation and job training initiatives. So we're real happy with that work.
That's outstanding. I think we have time for one more question, and it's: do boilers have to be clean before bioheating is added, or can it be added and mixed with the current fuel load?
Well, boilers should be cleaned. Boilers should be cleaned and serviced every year. Now, in the case of a well-maintained boiler that has been cleaned and serviced on a regular basis, and particularly if we know the service company and we know that they maintain a clean and fairly new equipment, then we wouldn't necessarily have to clean it. But in the case where we convert, for instance, a number four boiler, then absolutely that needs to be completely cleaned out before we put the biodiesel in. For the most cases, we try to just fit in with the existing maintenance of the equipment. So whether it's a on-road vehicle or a boiler, both of those machines need to be maintained on a regular basis. So we'll just go in with the biodiesel, in the normal maintenance schedule. So if it's a fleet vehicle, we might introduce the biodiesel after the normal scheduled fuel filter change. And so that way we avoid any additional charge for the conversion. And the same with the boiler. If it's been maintained on a regular basis, if they come and maintain it every fall, for instance, we'll start that season with the biodiesel heating oil, and therefore we won't add any additional costs. And we also do provide some boiler service in-house for our customers so that we make sure that their equipment is going to be functioning year-round.
Okay, thanks, Brent. And thanks for all your questions, and keep them coming. We will do our best after the webinar to answer anybody's questions that didn't get a chance to be answered online. So, Brent, thank you very much. And with that, we're getting towards the end of the webinar, but I do want to touch on some things before we go. I'll just bring the presentation up. Just 1 second, technical difficulties. Here we go. I just wanted to show some slides with some context and some links where you can find some more information on the biodiesel programs, the partnership opportunities, and funding sources. I'll start with the funding sources. EPA's Pollution Prevention Program, they have two grant programs that can be potential sources of funding for biodiesel work. They're run out of each of the 10 regional offices. The two different programs are the Pollution Prevention Grants Program and the Source Reduction Assistance Grants Program. And each one is a little bit different. The Pollution Prevention Grant funding provides 50% of the matching funds, and it's specifically targeted for state and tribal programs, and that those funds go towards supporting activities all across environmental media that reduce pollution. And there will be a request for proposals issued, we expect, sometime the end of February. The other grant program, the Source Reduction Assistance Program, that requires only 5% matching funds, and that's targeted to nonprofit organizations, state, county, municipals, and tribes. And this funding goes towards, it goes towards identifying better strategies for environmental protection and reducing or eliminating waste at the sources across the different environmental media, so air, water, land. This year's funding period this year's application period is expiring, but there will be opportunities probably next year. These are annual competitions, and there has been one each of the last 5 years, so we expect there will be another one next year. So I wanted to bring these programs to everyone's attention, and please, if you have more questions, please visit the link on here, www.epa.gov/region02/p2/grants.htm. And you can also contact Joe Bergstein. He's the regional coordinator here for those grants. So please take advantage of that if you're interested in obtaining funding for your biodiesel program. I also wanted to change the slide. There we go. I also wanted to encourage some municipalities and other organizations to make use of their local Clean Cities Coalition. The Clean Cities, that's a government and industry partnership. It's sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy, and they are really dedicated to meeting the different environmental and economic and energy security challenges, specifically by supporting decisions at the local level to reduce petroleum consumption. They have a network of 90 or so coalitions, and the contacts from the New York and New Jersey area listed here. And these coalitions, they really work on these public-private partnerships to promote alternative fuels and advanced vehicles. So they got a lot of valuable resources, and I really encourage you to take advantage of them. Visit the website or contact the contacts listed here. And finally, I did want to share some of these links. This is EPA, Department of Energy, and other sources. These are guides for using biodiesel or producing biodiesel. Some are even targeted to municipalities. So please follow these links, read more about it, and if you have questions, feel free to contact us. Once again, all these slides, these presentations, and the entire webinar with audio portion, it will be available coming up. And here is the link on this slide here you can follow. That's epa.gov/region2/sustainability/green communities/clean diesel. It's a mouthful, but follow that link, and you'll get access to these presentations and to this webinar. As a special thanks, I want to send out to the presenters. There were some really great presentations today, and I think very useful. If we weren't able to answer any of your questions, I'll give you an additional number you can call, or you can contact us. This number here is 1-877-NCDC-FACTS. That's 1-877-623-2322, or you can email cleandiesel@epa.gov. So thank you very much for participating, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon.